back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here, folks. And I want to, on the way back here, remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Your money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Kaleem Young remains with us here in the studio. Always good to she can do this with us and being co-hosting all the time. I love having her in the house.
Oh, having a good time.
And another woman is in the house who I've also known since she was very young, which is
very young.
Very young.
And skinny. You ain't say that part, Mark.
No, I did not say that part. Sheila Gaskins.
What?
Performance artist, poet, and stand-up comic and director of Theater Action Group. Good to have you here too, Sheila.
Yes, as it's well. Good to be here at 11 o'clock, y'all. What?
410-319-8888 is the number to call to join in on this conversation. So there's so much here. One of the things I looked at this morning when I first started preparing for the show today was this video that had just come out about a young man named, not how young he was, I don't know his age, Delron Small. Delron Small was a black man killed on July 4th by an off-duty police officer who I think also happened to be African-American, and was shot and killed him when he approached his car at a stoplight, not asking what he wanted. Why are you approaching my car? Did you need something? But he was shot, and apparently his wife and four-year-old daughter, or however this daughter was, watched the killing take place. And then you could see it on – you could see him being shot and then stumbling across the road, bouncing off a car, falling again, and then finally hitting the ground, right? So you see that, and you see the – you see Philandro Castile – dying in the car with his girlfriend describing his death and what just happened while it was happening on Facebook. You see Alton Sterling held down and then shot point-blank range by an officer. And then you watch his son completely fall apart when his mother is trying to say something about the death and he was just inconsolable. There's nothing he could do to you know, he was just mourning his dad being murdered in front of his eyes, literally. And so, and when I say literally, because all these people are dying in front of our eyes now.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, even if you've never seen it before in your life, you're not seeing it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
What is that doing? But there's many levels here. There's a political level, which we'll get to in a moment, what it opens up. But there's a personal thing going on here. What, and I read there's a piece in the New York Times this weekend about the families of the black folks who have made the news because they were killed by police over the last 2 years in America, and what the children in those families are going through, the nightmares, not being able to sleep alone, being terrified, seeing a policeman, a little girl who's 7 years old, starts crying, what, is he going to kill us like he killed my brother? And so there's a trauma associated with this. Yes. But the trauma of those at a distance – we're watching this. What does it do to us? What does it do to the children who are watching it? What does it do to families and communities as they're seeing people die around us in these videos?
Well, I know that it affects us deeply. And again, you guys was talking about that during slavery days. But to continuously see this trauma and to witness it, because though I am affected as a black person, you as a white person, Mark, are watching this. And it has to be going, something has to be going on with you too.
Oh, everybody.
And to witness this for years after years after years after years, that's a problem with that. And we become numb or we are desensitized or we don't feel at all. And it's not right. It's not right. There is no class for it. There is no, I can't go to the hospital and check myself in. We are truly affected by this to the point where it's like terror. Like, you don't want to go out. You don't want to go out, not because you're afraid you might get shot. You just don't want to go out, period. And then you only want to look at your Facebook page.
Right, right.
There is no filter whatsoever. I had issue when my kids were at a school, a nice little school. The teacher did a whole, during Black History Month, the white teacher did an assignment on Emmett Till.
Oh, good Lord.
But he didn't tell none of the parents what he was doing. And my daughters went to sleep, third, fourth grade. I don't want the lights off. What happened? I'm thinking, what happened? I don't want the lights off. Emmett Till images. I was like, Emmett Till? You mean to tell me a teacher was in the classroom teaching this to you all and did not even mention it to the parents? That is crazy. That is privilege. That is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are multiple levels of things that are going on when people are witnessing this. Mm-hmm. And these multiple levels of things that are going on differ depending on what body you inhabit and whose body you're witnessing being tortured, killed, murdered. For many Black people in this country, folks who, when we see these things, it's contributing to an ongoing feeling of cultural trauma, collective identity, and cultural memory and collective memory. You feel the pain of generations. You feel it unceasingly. You see it. You put yourself in there. You get to a space of empathy. For folks who don't necessarily look like those folks that are on the screen that are being murdered, oftentimes when they're watching these videos, there might be a spark of empathy. There's a spark of, oh my God, the horror of what's going on. But 4 years in this country, it's something I talk about a lot in my research. For years, the dehumanization of Blackness mm-hmm. and the spectacularized ways that we die have been used as ways to make white people see themselves as actual humans and Black folks as not. It's like someone else's torture has been the helping in the creation of someone else's identity. Or like a feeling of superiority. That's not your body being destroyed there. So we have these combinations, but it also is used as a space to spark activism on both sides and like feelings and movements and wanting to move forward and wanting to do something to change it. But I am always problematizing the idea of why does my pain
right.
have to be the thing that makes you decide that I'm human enough for you to do work for?
Right. Right.
Because that I'm human enough to act on.
Right.
So it's a complicated monster.
It is complicated.
About?
I mean, if you look back in our history and folks, your thoughts about what these videos are doing to you, how you've discussed them in your families, what has happened to with your kids when they've seen them, because it's hard not to see them, no matter how old your kids are, because they're all over YouTube, they're all over Facebook, they're everywhere. And they just they're omnipresent. So what? How do you respond to them? How do you respond with your children with them? 410-319-8888. You know, you said Emmett Till. I mean, it was Emmett Till's mother.
Right.
Mammy.
Who made
yes.
the decision
she decided.
To leave the coffin open.
Right.
Exactly.
And that was on the centerfold of Jet.
Exactly.
Not the centerfold, but it was in
right.
Jet magazine.
Yes.
And it was also then picked up by media across America.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was the beatings of people in Birmingham. And on the Pettus Bridge that mm-hmm. turned America around,
right.
around the civil rights movement,
right.
as was the death of Shawna Goodman and Cheney. We saw their pictures, but then saw their car being pulled out of the mud.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Yeah, it goes as far back as Private Gordon, the scourged back photograph. You always have the enslaved man with the scourged back.
Yeah, yeah, him, yeah.
It goes back as far as then.
Oh, you meant the 19th century?
Right. Yes, from 1836 that helped push more people into the abolitionist movement.
Right. Right.
Images of Black people in pain and wounding and death are the things that have always moved movements forward. But what is that doing for Black people who have to continuously see themselves being tortured?
Yeah,
and
why
dying?
Does it have to have some blood at the end and be icky? You know what I mean?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I interrupt you, Mark.
No, you're
think
not.
About,
no.
I think about sort of there's a lineage of history that goes along with these images. And these viral videos are just a part of an ongoing lineage of history of Black pain in a spectacularized way, in a mediated way, being used for many different purposes.
But if we're in a world that for 150 years or more has become more and more of a mediated place, a place mediated by media, I should say,
yeah.
in whatever forms, that is what moves people because you don't see it directly. If you're separated from it, you don't know what's happening, or you're not aware that it's happening, or you don't let yourself be aware that it's happening on any level of those things. But you see that. I mean, when you – so that the only way you're going to connect to it is if you see somebody show you an image of what it is. Otherwise, you don't see it. No matter what they're – what kind of – you know, it's like people didn't believe the Holocaust was happening.
Right.
Until the camps were opened up and they saw these people who were skin and bones living in these camps.
Right. Mm-hmm. But right? They also had propaganda. And they had films that said that, oh, this is awesome. Look what we're doing over here. So Hitler had a great scheme. He put these movies out that said, hey, ain't nothing going on. We having a good time over here.
Right, right, right.
So that was part of it as well. So this goes back to the lynchings with
photography.
Yes, with body parts being snatched up like souvenirs.
Sold, held,
neat
foils. Like,
you know, inviting people, like inviting people. There's going to be a lynching tonight. Y'all should come on down.
No, they were parties.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
There's
like
a difference.
Parties.
There's a difference. And I wrote this on, yes, the world of Facebook. I wrote this. There's a difference between watching and sharing versus seeing and witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major differences is context. One of the major differences is context. We get these viral videos. They come across our page. They come across our stage. They come across our television. And it's like you're inundated with it. And it's just like you're watching, but you're not seeing. You're not witnessing. You're not sitting in a space of empathy to be like, okay, I am being moved forward from it. I am being moved forward from this. I'm actually seeing the context. So you had spectators at lynchings. Who were there, who were not participating, but they were participating by watching it.
Yeah.
So then I think Susan Sontag talks about it on pain, her art, her book on pain and viewing practices, when she's talking about what does it mean when we take lynching photography and put it in a gallery?
Right.
Are we going and contributing to the spectacularization of this pain again? Are we re-traumatizing these people? Are we re-traumatizing ourselves? And this is something that we have to really grapple with. And a lot of it has to do with context. Context and preparation and the intention for why you are looking. Interrogate why you're looking.
I mean, someone just questioned here, I wonder why media outlets have decided not to show ISIS videos of beheadings, but they're okay with showing videos of black people being killed by the police.
You ain't never said no more truth.
Snap. That is awesome. That's a great statement. I saw the movie Unbroken.
I think the statement was made by Mark Gunnery, as my producer back there, typing little things over to me.
I saw the movie Unbroken, and then the movie that's the Angelina Jolie one about the white man that was in some kind of camp, a Japanese concentration camp.
Yeah.
And if you watch the whole movie, you never see him get beat down.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see him get beat down.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody will strike, then they will cut, and then you will see his body afterwards. You never see the physical of him getting beaten.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a white man.
Yeah, but you do see white people getting beaten in movies all the time. I mean, that's not... So
by other
that
white
kind.
People.
Yeah.
By other white people. You don't see him by nobody else.
I don't know if that's necessarily
all
true,
I'm saying is this movie, this
I hear
movie
what you're saying. Yeah.
Refused to show that part. And that's
right.
That's a privilege thing.
But it's also, you know, you see other, well, that's a little, maybe too much of a sidetrack before you open the phones. I mean, I was thinking about the pieces that we're watching recently on some films where they decided not to show the violence, but you just knew the violence took place.
Mm-hmm. Like the shooting of the newscasters by the black man.
Mm-hmm. They said that was too violent to show.
They didn't show that at all.
They didn't show that.
Then let that be something else and see what we will see. All I'm saying is it's two different worlds, and we all know that. And there's two different rights, and we all know that. And people are treated differently, and we all know that. And we need to start talking about it.
Yeah.
We need to make race a normal thing, because when we don't, it's a disservice. And that's how people can walk.
It's about sentimental storytelling. It's about what stories will be used to make other people feel more real in the world.
But this is Tyrone Keyes has been on the show numerous times, put on Facebook the other day. And Tyrone Keyes is a Republican black activist and a very thoughtful man. Wrote that showing Sterling's murder is vital. To do so is as important as displaying the reality of what happened to Emmett Till. Granted, it may offend the delicate sensibilities of the squeamish, but airing that video is necessary if people are to understand the problem in its most graphic sense. Let's take it out of the abstract and world of high-minded talk and armchair revolutionaries and get down in the mud and understand what's taking place.
See, I would have no problem with that, but they show every one of the murders. It's not like he's the only one. It's been thousands of murders, and we see them all. That's what my problem is. We see them all, and I'm trying to figure out. And
I'm sorry, delicate sensibilities, that comes with a level of condescension and a lack of acknowledgement of the fact that this is causing trauma for people. You cannot dismiss trauma. You cannot dismiss the actual psychological issues of having to live in a space of constantly feeling like you are about to be killed, that you are going to die violently. There are traumatized children all throughout this city who are always living in a space of trauma. And until we get to a point where we're actually talking about this trauma and not saying, oh, these are delicate sensibilities, you are doing a disservice to collective pain.
And in these two particular videos, let's open the phones here, that we're talking about, I mean, the difference, I think, between this and seeing Tamir Rice be shot, seeing Sandra Bland being pulled out of her car, all these horrible things, seeing Eric Garner die on that sidewalk, is that in these two videos, these last two videos at least, not the one in New York, but the one in St. Paul and the one in Baton Rouge, you actually saw people who were bleeding out and dying. You saw that, why those were so particularly traumatic. I mean, I can't watch them anymore. I saw it the first time. It was like, oh my God. It was like, you know, it's.
I forced myself to bear witness.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I watched.
I'm not even doing right. that. After I saw Eric get jumped on like a National Geographic film where mm-hmm. lions are attacking some type of animal.
Some giant.
It was the same thing. It was a bunch of lions jumping on a deer or some kind of ram or some type of animal, and they took him down, and there was no bloodshed. But I couldn't witness that. That was wrong, and that does something to me. And to know that people can literally get off on it is there's a problem. There's porn. There's fetishes about this thing. This people are liking this.
So, unless you can jump in, Cleo, let me open the phones and let people kind of see what they're thinking with all this. And we're sitting here with Sheila Gaskins and Kalima Young, and you at 410-319-8888. Let's go to James on the east side. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
First of all, I'd like to commend you two ladies. Y'all hitting everything right on the head. Y'all not leaving nothing out. Y'all basically said everything that I feel. I'm 59 years old, and sometimes I'm scared to go outside. Because, yet Mark said, what do you feel? You feel fear. You know, if the police see you, you can't even say hello, officer. If you say something, you get basically jumped on verbally. You like, oh, and I had that experience myself. I just threw my hands in the air. You know, I wasn't joking, but I felt like he was going to attack me because I spoke to him. Yeah. But you two ladies had put everything in perspective. You know, this is two different worlds. They got their world. To them, we are second-class citizens.
Right.
And that's not going to change, not in my lifetime anyway. You know, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I talk to her all the time about, I said, if the police say something, you just basically do with the police, but you can do that, and you still don't get a break, because what is a person supposed to do if the police come to you hollering and screaming and not even giving you a chance to speak? And if you scratch your ear, he was reaching for something, or she was reaching for something. Right. And basically, like I said, Mark wanted to know how I feel as a black man, and I'm 59 years old. I wouldn't even call the police if something happened to me. I wouldn't call them. I would just try to deal with it the best way I can. And then, like, say one more thing, Mark.
Sure, go ahead.
The problem with that, they left one word off of the Black Lives Matter sign because and people don't seem to get it. And that one word is two, T-O-O, Black Lives Matters, two. And then maybe some of the whites or whatever don't understand it, then they know what to means. Mm-hmm. That's the word they're missing.
As in also, right?
No, I hear that, James. I mean, I think that's when I've seen these email conversations going on. I mean, Facebook conversations about that. A young friend of mine, well, not young, but in her 40s, I guess, I don't know, but Deirdre McElroy, who kind of grew up in my home, she is a woman of mixed parentage, and she writes about being brown in America and what that means. Now you see it, and people writing back about not understanding what Black Lives Matter, why it's not all lives matter. I think there's a disconnect, and I think that James hit that disconnect in a very deep way.
Mm-hmm.
And all lives matter when Black Lives Matter too, or as my friend sent to me from out in Wyoming on the res, he wrote to me, he said, and out here, Indian lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's the same thing. As I keep saying over again, the group that has the largest per capita number of their people killed by the police in America
mm-hmm.
are Native people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. And I am so aware of that.
And the largest number of women raped.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
By people who are not of their own
right.
ethnic
mm-hmm.
group
yes.
are Native women.
Yes.
Tribal sovereignty laws.
Yes.
And so
mm-hmm.
all those things are really, you know, we have to kind of really, this is such an encompassing piece.
Right.
Before we jump back to y'all, let me just get one more quick call in here.
Cool.
Well, we're
going
to get all the calls in at 410-319-8888. But let's go to Darla calling in from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, hello. Darla. Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to say that I'm teaching my 15-year-old white boy how to drive, and he's understandably scared because I don't think that this only happens to black people. And I agree with the previous caller that black people or black lives matter too. And I think that a driver's attitude has something to do with it. I think that a policeman can be scared and that has something to do with it. But it's pretty scary for all of our young kids right now.
It is. It is. And so you're calling from San Antonio?
Yes.
So I'm just curious, what conversations are taking place in the community where you live?
Well, we live in a very diverse area, and I believe that our cops are thought to be respectful, but just night before last, the police headquarters had shots fired at it. So there's plenty of conversations about everyone. I think that San Antonio in general has less racism than some of the other major cities in America. I don't feel it so much here. Of course, I'm white, so one could say that, of course, I don't feel it. But I have many diverse friends, and when we talk about it, we just try to understand each other and believe that whatever one of us has said has happened to us, we believe it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I deeply appreciate you calling in from Texas and listening to us via the web. But I'm glad to have you with us. Some thoughts before we hit break?
Well, I know that I wanted to talk about these slave codes, and I don't know if you guys talked about them earlier, mm-hmm. but one of the slave codes was that slave masters who mistreat or mm-hmm. even murdered their slave never got punished by law. Slaves could not testify against whites, and white witnesses or juries were unwilling to testify or convict anyone against their clan or kin.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just reliving all of these ways of life during the South. One of the codes, and I'm going to get off this slave thing, but one of the codes was that the Southerners required an expectation of absolute obedience and deference, which is respect, from all Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you jump out of line, you are up a creek.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be docile and pay attention and don't do anything. Don't make no black noise or there is a problem.
Right.
So, and this was 1800s. We're still living that.
All right. Can I just have one quick moment?
Yes, then we'll take a break and go back to the phones. And Mr. E and Ock and Kadri are going to come to your calls when we come back.
Our caller from San Antonio. And Sheila, yes. Bring it back to slavery because we need to, because the history of our modern police force is in slave patrols and night watches. Okay,
patrolmen.
So no, bring it back.
Slave catcher.
But
go ahead.
The last statement that our caller made about when people say that they've experienced something, we believe them. I think that that is a very powerful statement of how we do anti-racist work, right? when you say that something is going on, believe them. I think the complication that we have right now is that people are relying on viral, graphic, spectacularized images of our pain to be the thing that says, okay, now do you believe us? When I should simply be able to say, as a black person in America, that these are the violences that have been enacted upon me by the state. And you don't need to actually see my body writhing in pain to say, okay, I believe you. And that's where we have a big complication here.
It is. Then let's talk about that when we get back a little bit. Because I think that, that as we go to break here, I think that that is a reality, a real complication. And because we're the society we are, one could argue that without that, nobody's consciousness will change, as horrible as that is to say. We're here with Sheila Gaskins and Kalima Young, and you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@sanashow.org, by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. Mr. E, in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Listen, I just want to relate some short things to you. One thing is that my granddaughter, 14 years old, knew the last young man that was killed here. Chucky is his name.
Mm.
I forget his name, but she said she knew him as well.
The rapper?
But she asked, say again?
The rapper or someone who was
killed? Yeah, I think it was the rapper.
Oh, okay.
She was very upset, I can tell you that.
Mm.
And she went to one of the demonstrations, but she sat down with me just last night, and asked me, said, Poppy, I'm scared. What's going on? And I told her, I said, well, listen, you got to understand one thing. When I was your age, a lot was going on with our people. I was raised up through the civil rights movement, the black power movement, the neocultural thing, all of that. And I'm now 73 almost. And I'm just at a dilemma as to what I can tell my children. I mean, you know, this is my baby granddaughter. She's troubled by all of these events, these killings and all of them on both sides of the equation. And I just want to, you know, that's why I'm listening to your show and other shows like this, so we can talk about some things and maybe come up with some kind of solutions, if at all possible. Mm-hmm. I just want to relate that to you, Mark. I appreciate you being on the radio, man.
No, I appreciate the call and what you're wrestling with your granddaughter. And we're close to being the same age, and so I understand that. And I think that the level of violence that's taking place today and are visually seeing it on the media is more intense, I think, than it has been in decades. Mm. I mean, you both grew up in Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
right? I grew up in Baltimore a little bit before y'all, but I grew up in Baltimore. And there's always been violence and tension. There's always been police abuse against black people, especially in this city. But there's a level of violence and abuse taking place now. The tone is even different.
Hmm.
You know, it's the shootings are happening more than they ever happened before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I remember when this guy Crazy Willie was killed on our street corner by a police in Garrison Liberty Heights. And that when that happened, I remember the reaction in the community was they were always used to being thrown up against the wall and beaten and, you know, pistol whipped and arrested and all that kind of stuff always happened. But that killing of Crazy Willie was not something that you expected.
Mm-hmm.
Now we expect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's – and I think that most people who do not live in a working class Puerto Rican neighborhood, a working class Mexican neighborhood, working class black neighborhood, a native neighborhood don't understand that.
Right.
At all.
Right.
But we're in a very horrendous moment, and I think we're now, and we have this new media that puts it in our face. So how does Mr. E talk to his granddaughter about that?
Well, I think one of the things that you said that was outstanding, you were saying that at that time, too, because I was raised in Baltimore, there was also some love in the community. And there was also a sense of village. So if I did something wrong, it went back to my mama. And so there was a sense of family. So if that happened, I can go to my mother or my grandmother or everybody would be surrounded talking about this thing. Now we have a screen. So we have no touch. We have no feel anyway. And so now we're watching this stuff almost like a video game. that it's almost not even real. And I said that to say he's going to have to really sit his daughter down and have those conversations about what you can and cannot do. I know the Panthers were really instrumental. They were like, look, take your clothes off. If the police stop you, get butterball naked and go out with your hands up. Because this way they can't say you had a weapon, you ain't had no gun. And that way they will see that you are not armed. So they literally had to teach that type of thing. I've been raised in a race-aware house forever. And I've been having these conversations with my kids for a long time. To the point where they're like, Mommy, again? You and the daggone race again? Daggone it, Mommy. But now my kids are older and they're in their 20s and they're like, we've always talked about this, Mommy. I see some people who are really affected. I'm not that affected because we always talked about this. So he's going to have those conversations, and it's unfortunately, it's going to have to be normalized.
I think there's going to have to be those conversations. I think there has to be... I want to go back to your conversation about love. The fact that there was a point where people actually acknowledged, and there are still places where people acknowledge that these things are traumatic for groups of people, but we need to hold space.
Right, right.
We need to hold space. We need to have dedicated, held space for the amount of trauma that is occurring when these images happen. There needs to be a discussion afterwards. There needs to be a conversation about when you're sharing it and when you're not and what your intention is.
Mm-hmm.
So like holding space around these viewings and then also improved viewing practices to help people understand, well, what's your intent for watching it? Are you watching this because it's going to help you to be a more active citizen against police brutality? Are you watching it because you want to feel that level of empathy and sympathy with that individual? Or are you watching this for some kind of pleasure? And let's interrogate that as well. That we need to have ongoing conversations about our watching. And that also needs to be paired with creating intentional spaces where we can sit in the muckety muck together and then we can feel it and acknowledge that trauma is occurring and has been occurring. The worst thing that we can do is see this as an individual pain that we're feeling.
That's
when
true.
We watch these things.
That's
right
true.
And to some extent, sometimes when we're sharing virally, we're trying to call for a collective like feeling of like, you feel my pain now? Yeah, too. But that has to be taken out of the screen and brought into actual real people touching existences, spaces within communities where you can be freaking sad. There needs to be teachers who have children that are coming into the classroom who are traumatizing. I'm a college teacher that says, you know what? There's some traumatic jazz going on right now. If you need an extension on your paper, mental health break, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
For young people who are activists, who are out in these streets doing that work, we need to acknowledge that they're doing emotional labor and provide allowances for those things. Like there are ways that we need to respond with a clear understanding that we're living in a moment of cultural trauma. And that happens, and the ways we respond has to be on multiple levels and institutions.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Let me open the phones here. I don't know why I flashed on this thing with what Sonia Santelisa is, the new CEO of City Schools.
Oh, Lordy.
When she and they said to her that Doreen McKissen was arrested in Baton Rouge in the demonstrations, her response was something like, it was okay. The social justice is why he has the job he has.
Boom.
Which I found really interesting on her part.
The love labor is labor.
That was really that struck me as you were saying that. 410-319-8888. Kadria, you've been hanging on for a long time. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Marcia's guest and everything.
Good morning.
You know, I hate to be the doomsday bringer, okay? I said this before, and you always balk at me. But see, the stuff that's happening now is pushing us closer. There's no getting back. There's no reforming for Caucasian people. I hate to tell you this. This sadism, that's what it is, sadism and masochism that's being displayed now, this is part and parcel of the history. Just look at the Greeks. Just look at the Romans. Just look at the English. They invented the chains, the stuff that stretched your bones, the pit and the pendulum, okay? The Greeks fought each other naked in the ring till one was dead. And the English, you know, their savagery is just unbelievable with the incest and everything. It was never part and parcel of any non-white people in the world history, as far as I know. This is just coming out of them because they want nothing else to look like Obama in that White House, even though he is their denatured slave, and I'm sorry for whoever feels that hurt. But this is the reality. No way we can do this except we come to ourselves, get our own laws, chastise our own people, and rule our own neighbors. White men never been for us, and they never will be, by and large, okay?
Kadri, thanks for your thoughts. I really do appreciate you always calling in. Your responses?
She need to get that on a T-shirt. That's all I'm saying. I want to think that there can be something shifting. I hate to believe that this is it. And I guess that's the sensitive nature of myself. Will I ever see solidarity? No. Do I think that that there is a fear amongst white people that now all of these people who are color are more than you, and so therefore I'm scared the brown people going to do what the white people did to them? Do I think that that's a reality? I think that is a reality. But I do think that there is hope. Even as bad as this is, I think people will shift and make it more comfortable than it is. And I think people will share in this equity struggle. Because, again, this is it. We don't get no retakes. And I would hate for it to go back to the Hitler days and when you hiding people and things like that. But I really believe that there is some hope. I believe that with more education, people will shift. And that's just the positive nature of me.
I think the system has failed and is screwed and wasn't designed to help people live. But I think in the midst of that, people have been living brilliantly and vibrantly. I think that there is a level of being able to say, well, this isn't, if you're going to see me as an alien, then I'm just going to be a happy alien and make my own magic over here. And that's okay. And you're going to appreciate all that magic in some way, shape, or form. But I'm not going to be concerned about how you see it, if you think it's respectful, if it fits these norms that weren't designed for me, my body. So I think that there are multiple ways that you can tune in or turn on or drop out in this conversation. I think there's something to be said for collective work and collective communities. Small enclaves of folks doing it the way that they need to do it for themselves so that they can feel that they are healed, so that they can feel like they are holding each other accountable. And that's important. And I think folks have been doing it and will do it, and we'll just see more of it.
There's read an email that just came in from Lindsay. I think there have been over the years all kinds of solidarity that have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And they've grown over the years in terms of numbers of people who are not African American being in those struggles.
That's true.
Where you're talking about the solidarity of SNCC, solidarity of the abolitionist movement,
right.
Solidarity of SNCC,
right.
The solidarity when the Black Panthers and the Young Patriots, which were the kind of the Appalachian version of the Black Panther Party, white people, mm-hmm. Young Lords,
mm-hmm.
Brown Berets, together in solidarity. And you look in the Black Lives Matter movement now.
Mm-hmm.
You look at these demonstrations, people in the streets. They're not just black people in the
That's
streets.
That's true.
Exactly.
That's true.
Right?
Exactly.
And there's a consciousness growing, I think. It's, never before in the history of America have you had 25-30% of white people in America saying that racism is a problem.
Right.
That has to be ended. That's a phenomenal number given where this country started.
Right.
That means right. A whole lot of other folks got some ways to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even
and unfortunately,
during
those people have power and sit in policy and have power and money.
And even doing when Trayvon first started,
right.
That conversation is totally different till now.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Asian people are writing letters to their ancestors trying to bring them on board. So I think all of this is just magic. I think it's just amazing.
There were all these signs I saw in one of the BLM demonstrations was Asians for Black Lives Matter. You
yes.
said Asians. They were holding up.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, this is.
Oh, yeah. Folks is in the struggle.
This
folks
is, yeah.
are in.
So, and so Lindsay writes, and then I'll go to the phones. Ernest, want to come to your call next. Lindsay wrote in, can you please speak to the changes in the police? as I watched the videos, speaking of videos, which we're supposed to be talking about, as I watched videos of the protests in Baton Rouge yesterday, it struck me that the police are already dressed in riot gear with machine guns, approaching a crowd of unarmed citizens that includes little children. It's a setup for tragedy. We have militarized and weaponized the police into an invading army.
Yes.
There's no more protect and serve.
Oh, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's been a steady situation since the war on drugs and the allowing of police forces to become more and more militarized and have access to military-grade weapons for the war on drugs, which was totally designed to oppress and disenfranchise black and brown and poor people. So the police are just doing what they've been trained and set up to do for the last 30 years, and they look the way that they're supposed to look.
And there was incredible. The images are powerful. There was this picture of a young black woman in a long skirt standing in front of a line of police.
The Tiananmen Square, yeah.
And it was like Tiananmen Square, but it was in Baton Rouge.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then the next picture you saw was these Star Wars-clad police officers, I can't think of a better word right now, gathering around her and then arresting her and dragging her away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and could there have been a different response by the police?
Oh, my goodness.
Right? I'm saying, right? Yeah. But that image is also another image that people see.
Right.
So these images are like, it's not just the images of black people being mowed down by police or black people being killed in communities or whatever, but it's also those images of the police.
Right.
That are also changing consciousness. Right. Making people question.
Right, right.
Make people think.
Right.
Yeah. When did the image of the police go from officer friendly to SWAT cop? Right?
Right.
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 I think people seeing the militarized police sort of helps them see the intensity of what people have been saying about the harming police presence in their neighborhoods for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just like, you can see it in sharp relief now.
One of the things that happened in Dallas that I heard or read about, they said that the police said that they didn't want to put on the riot gear because this was a friendly moment. And then that...
Micah Xavier.
Yeah. Then that happened. So I'm assuming now they're like, you know what? We ain't got no more friendly moments. We just going to gear up anyway, just to prevent that type of thing. I remember doing an uprising and I was on, I think it was Biddle Street, one of those streets, and we were on lockdown. And I saw two MTA buses full of officers, but they were all white with blonde hair and they had these blue uniforms on. And it was something out of Nazi Germany. Oh. And I've never, because, you know, other people came to help out when we were doing this thing. And it was so, I just went to that moment in history books. And they were going down the street and they all looked alike on the bus, two busloads full of them. That was amazing to me. Like, where they come from? Like, it was amazing.
Virginia, Pennsylvania, someplace.
I'm telling you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Ernest, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning, Ernest.
Yeah, I think about what's been going on over the years. You would say Marion Carey is a black female, 34 years old, shot multiple times in Washington, D.C., was all on television. Not a police was charged.
Mm.
Nobody went to jail.
Nope.
For that.
Mm-mm.
And it was not this hue and cry and preachers out and mourning and flowers and all this kind of stuff. None of that. Saman Thomas in Baltimore City. Police shot Saman Thomas. Of course, he was in a stolen car, but he was running away. Shot him in the back. They left him to die in Lincoln Park.
Mm-hmm.
Until a neighbor called and said, "There's a young man on my lawn dying."
Hmm.
So the police got their stuff together and got their lives together. And Patricia Jessamy took him to court. They had a mistrial or something.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was forgotten.
Hmm.
The prosecuting attorney, Timothy, Tim Dorey, after the case was over, later on he gets a promotion. He's a judge. He's sitting there over police that commit these kind of atrocities. Do you think he's going to find a police guilty? No, but I think of Xavier Johnson as a model. Here's a young man that went to Afghanistan for this country. And then when he comes back in this country, plus he has studied the history of black people in this country, how they've been persecuted and brutalized.
Yes.
Since we've been in this country over and over, even in Ferguson, after Michael Brown was murdered by the police, prosecutors refused to prosecute this thug cop, and then they continued to kill people in Ferguson. A guy with a mental case with a butter knife. Now this can't go on, and unfortunately, this is the only thing that is going to make these people get an understanding that we're not going to take it anymore. And these preachers preaching and all this holding hands, when police commit murderous crimes in this country, all the police departments in this country back the police departments. Except in Abner Louima, he is a guy, they right. take him to a police station, pull his pants and underwear down, and take up a baton,
yeah,
and put it up his rectum, and they started that thin blue line there. Well, we're not going to talk. It's a thin blue line. With the commissioner, that's safer, said we're going to suspend everybody in the district. When they suspended everybody in the district, they didn't think about no policeman's bill of rights and none of that. Somebody started talking. Now they got this case with Freddie Gray. You got a black judge appointed by Ehrlich, a Republican, and he was born in America as a black man. He's a history major in college, and he doesn't understand what's going on.
Hmm.
And he hasn't found anybody responsible, and he's not going to find anybody responsible when this is shown all over the world.
All right, so, okay, let the panel come back. I appreciate the call.
I just know slave masters who mistreat or murdered their slaves never got punished by law. That's all I know.
But a couple of things what Ernest said, and I think we have to kind of be honest and wrestle with. We didn't see what happened to Micah Xavier Johnson and how he died, but we know he was blown up.
By a drone.
By a drone. Or a robot, actually.
Yeah.
Like a drone that we've sent in.
Yeah.
That, and they just blew up the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So... And whenever these things happen, there are people who will say that he was a liberation fighter and what he did was justified, which is basically what Ernest and other people are saying, and some other people are saying as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't ignore that state of mind or that thinking, right? And I remember that from the 60s, things that happened in the same kind of vein.
Right.
So how do we think about that? And again, that is part of media and how we look at it. I mean, at first, Balache said, oh, they're only showing him in his African garb. Well, that wasn't true because they actually showed him in all array of garb, including his military uniforms and everything else. And people say, oh, he was trained by the military to kill. Actually, he learned how to shoot in a Dallas combat club where he learned how to shoot and kill and move around and make those moves, not in the Army. He actually, because in the Army he was something else, and he learned how to do that when he got out of the Army. But I'm just saying all that to say, so our media, our thoughts, who was Micah Xavier Johnson? How does that fit into this as part of what Ernest was bringing up?
Micah Xavier Johnson was a trained, legally carrying gun owner in America who had access to a high-powered weapons to kill people en masse, like many others.
and as the young man who was arrested and accused of being part of it, because he was carrying an AR-15 in the demonstration in Dallas, marching down the street, protesting what happened in Baton Rouge and St. Paul when the firearm got, and because he could legally carry an AR-15 in Dallas, and then got arrested because his brother turned the gun over, and they still arrested him.
Right.
See, I don't want to admit, don't mistake this. I'm not killing anybody.
I'm like, there's an open carry law, right?
Right.
I'm doing my open carry.
And Alton Sterling was carrying a gun.
Uh-huh. Openly.
Because you're in Louisiana and you're allowed to carry those guns.
Right. And he said it. Let them know.
You reap what you sow. I'm sorry. It's just if you're going to put guns in the hands of people, right, you're going to have some people who are going to use those guns in such a way that can cause mass pain for people. And no matter how you want to slice politically, Micah, that's what he did.
And if you look at the statistics, by the way, that the states that have the most policemen being shot are the states that have the most lax gun laws.
Hmm. Well, I know in Camden, New Jersey, the police force is doing some, they're turning some things around. And it's because more people of color join the force, mm-hmm. and they have this attitude of going out and policing, walking the beat. I saw some TV show where they had the community were policing the community. Like they were like I guess you could say deputies, and their role was to address some of the things that was happening in their community. I think we need to go to these type of things because this because of the skin you in, getting shot ain't working.
I'm thinking about the caller we had earlier when he called in talking about his granddaughter, Mr.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just blew up the name. I should have written it down. I apologize. And I was thinking, what do you say to your kid? You know, what do you say to your child watching these things and seeing them happening on video? And I think that's a time maybe also for a history lesson about America and how every generation has to stand up and struggle because it's not done yet.
Right.
And now this is what's being exposed right now. And this exposure is something that, you have to be careful always in your dealings with the world and dealings with police. But this is just like your grandfather might have marched in the picket line to end segregation in Baltimore, and maybe your great grandfather was great grandmother was a woman who fled enslavement and joined the struggle. That's the struggle moves and keeps on going.
Exactly.
It's not ended, and you're stuck in that, and that's a world we're in, and you have to be aware and console her. All you can do is put your arms around your son and say, we love you. We want to protect you as much as we can, but the reality is there. Not to be feared. You don't have to be scared. Just be aware. And just try to help them get the fear out of their hearts.
I think helping them understand their history, and I think all of us having to just say and collectively breathe, I never believed in the first place, but to collectively just accept the fact that that lie of post-racial was completely a lie and always was and always will be.
Maybe not always will be, I hope.
At least I feel like in my lifetime so far.
No, I'm not counting.
Having been fed that story.
I don't know. I didn't think we were going to see a black president. So
Having a black president, we had more white nationalist organizations get more guns.
But still, I never thought.
Right.
You know, that's a marker, but maybe our markers for what we see as moving forward as a people shouldn't be tied to those particular moments, right? Maybe our markers of how we move forward should be tied more to how humanely we treat one another and how we hold systems accountable.
Well, I want to thank the two of you. This has been a great discussion. Thank all of you for calling in. So the ones we did not get to Marie, Clarence, and the others, I'm sorry we tried to get as many callers as we could. I want to thank two good friends for being in the studio here, Sheila Gaskins and Kalima Young. Thank you both so much for being here in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging with these 2 hours, Kalima.
Yes.
Yeah, no problem.
And on the way out of here, I want to remind you all and invite you all to join me this Thursday night, July 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Frederick Douglass Isaac Myers Maritime Museum to celebrate the inaugural season of Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, WEA's newest innovative documentary series. These women have done incredible work over these 12 episodes, and come help us celebrate that. You can get information about tickets and more on Facebook at Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City. And join us there Thursday night, July 14th, and let's celebrate what these women have done and keep it going as well. And thank you all for calling in and writing in and making this show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.